Oh, help me, please, doctor, I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. It's sleeping, it's a fainting. Can't you please tear it out and preserve it right there in that jar?
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Melissa Yancey, author of the new collection of short fiction, Dog Years. Melissa's a graduate of Linfield College in McMinnville. She currently lives in Los Angeles and works as a fundraiser for healthcare causes. This experience plays a part in many of Dog Years' stories, which, as Melissa explains, set the miracles of modern medicine against everyday life, like awkward first dates, the indignities of air travel, and trips to the local big box store. Dog Years won this year's Drew Hines Literature Prize, sponsored by the University of Pittsburgh Press, and one of the most prestigious awards for a book of short fiction. In the words of Anthony Doerr, Melissa Yancey's stories make me swoon with recognition. They're funny and sad in the same breath. They're incredibly well executed. They're about the endlessly fascinating machinery of relationships, about the weird intersections of medical technology and human dignity, and about the way time catches up with everyone in the end. Dog Years is cause for celebration. Melissa Yancey, thanks for being here on KBOO.
Thanks, Ken. It's a treat to be here.
You're part Oregonian, too.
And it really brings me back. I was just telling Ken, as we were walking around the studio, it brings me back to my college radio days.
At Linfield?
Yes, and it feels like real Portland. I spent a lot of time in the college radio station.
You grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. You came to Oregon to go to Linfield in McMinnville. How did you get to Arizona to Linfield, and what was that change in scenery and culture like?
I had never seen a squirrel growing up.
They don't have squirrels in
Arizona.
They
don't have squirrels. They have pigeons. That's about it. So the first time I got a glimpse of Oregon green, the trees, Multnomah, the gorge, I was visiting my grandparents who lived in Eastern Oregon.
It was where?
In La Grande.
Oh, okay. My wife grew up in Pendleton, Oregon.
Okay. You know it well then. So That was our only trip we'd ever taken to see my grandparents. I was 16 at the time, and I couldn't believe how beautiful everything was. And it was just the antithesis of Phoenix in every way. And I think that was the appeal for me. And Linfield is a great little college, a great value. It attracts some students who might not go there otherwise, except that they have excellent scholarship programs. And that's what brought me there.
And you now work in Los Angeles as a fundraiser in the healthcare industry. I hope this is still current, but I got your official title as Senior Director of Corporate Foundation and Research Relations.
Hopefully no colleagues are listening. But yes, that is you got my full title. You got it exactly right.
going from that to Dog Years, so we got a little background there. You've said that 5 of the 9 stories in Dog Years were inspired directly from your work life as a fundraiser in the medical field. They were inspired, quote, in a Law and Order ripped from the headlines way. I was wondering, is that just a happy accident, or was it part of the plan when you started working in healthcare and wrote at the same time?
It wasn't part of the plan, but it became part of the plan and the reason to sort of stay in the field that I'm in. I worked for a children's hospital for about 6 years, and I never thought I would work in medicine. I'm squeamish as a person, so the idea of being in that environment, especially with sick kids, just was inconceivable to me, but a good friend of mine worked there and convinced me to come for a tour. And before I knew it, I was sold and working in medicine. And even so, I would say I was attracted to the lives of the patients and the families, but I didn't really get the spark for medicine for a number of years until I met the fetal surgeon that one of the stories is about. And that was a transformative experience.
Oh, so that's based on an actual person.
It is.
It's the second story in the book called Consider This Case.
Yes. And so the longer I worked in medicine, the more I think as a matter of efficiency, I decided to treat my day job more like research. And when you work in a top hospital, you're exposed to really extreme situations. You're not just working in healthcare. You're working with the person who invented the PET scanner, or one of the top cancer researchers in the world. So the exposure to really brilliant, strange individuals and remarkable stories is so present that you kind of can't help but write about that. And it makes me feel like I'm making good use of the time that I'm away from writing.
And that surgeon in the book, Julian, a fetal surgeon, he definitely kind of fits that description. Brilliant, a bit socially awkward.
No, that's a good question. The actual surgeon is this really lovely, a saint on earth. He has three beautiful children, a beautiful wife. He's one of the most emotionally generous doctors I've ever worked with. And surgeons are not known for being emotionally generous.
A little more arrogant or kind of
by and large, they can sometimes live up to that stereotype. And with him in particular, fetal surgery is a very new field. There are only maybe a dozen people in the whole country who do what he does. I was able to watch a surgery in the operating room, and it was such a life-changing experience for me. I thought, I have to write about this. I have to write about this guy. But he's such a nice guy. That didn't make for very interesting fiction. So I really wanted to think about what would it be like to have this job but to not be able to have children, maybe not even want to have children. And that got me thinking about a different kind of character that I would make Julian. And then I had this fascination with this gentleman who was the curator of the White House.
That's Julian's father.
Yes. Uh-huh. The father is also based on a real person who I had read about. I knew one of his children. So I had heard these stories about this curator and what a character he was. And there were old articles about him in Time magazine from the 1970s that painted such a strong portrait of an individual. And so those two stories came together, father and son, and that's when it started to get interesting.
I want to go back to Oregon here for a second. It's played a big part of your life, not just Linfield, but you attended a Tin House Writers Workshop here in 2010, which marked a turning point, I read on your website, for your book of short stories, especially a class you took with Anthony Dewar, who wrote the novel, of course, All the Light We Cannot See. Can you tell us about the effect of that workshop, what effect that had on your work and your desire to continue as a writer?
Yes. He probably thinks I'm a stalker because I've credited him so much, but a lot of it is hearing a message at the time that you are ready to hear it as a writer. That makes such a big difference. And until you're ready to receive what someone has to give you, it may not make that much difference. And it was just the right time in my life. I'd been working on novels for a long time and had tried to sell a novel that I'd spent at least 5 years on. And it was 2008. The industry was a mess. Terrible time to try to sell a novel. So I took a break from that. And I hadn't been in a workshop setting for years, and I'd heard great things about Tin House, and I knew it was July in Portland, which is, of course, the best time.
We have nice summers. Yeah.
To be in Portland. So I wanted to go, and I just got so much out of the experience. I always recommend Tin House to people. They do such a great job of structuring the day so that you maximize every minute there, and the faculty are really second to none. And I think what they do well is they have a lot of brilliant short fiction writers. And I don't think I'd taken that many classes from short fiction writers before. And Tony Dore is such a technician. And I felt like he really gave me permission to treat each story like a novel and to really put 100% into each piece. And I think before that, I kind of saw short fiction as a means to an end.
Means to an end, meaning getting your name out and publishing in journals and then writing that novel?
Yes, even though I loved writing short fiction and I love reading short fiction, but there's so much pressure put on writers to produce a novel that I didn't spend the time I could have spent with each story. And that experience really changed that.
I wanted to talk about how I came to the book. The elephant in the room right now is we're doing this interview just a few days after the presidential election. kind of a pall of shock and sadness has descended on many Americans, especially here in Portland and probably a lot of other big cities, big American cities, maybe not the countryside. The copy of your book was sent to me and it arrived after Election Day on Wednesday, so just a few days ago. I started reading in a coffee shop, and actually it turned out to be just the medicine I needed at the time. It brought out a humanity and compassion, and I was just angry. I didn't have any of those things. As I was reading them in the coffee shop, I was actually tearing up at the table. I mean, it's so beautiful, and you just feel a connection. So that tearing up in a good way, I think, if they ever let me back at the coffee shop, made too much of a scene. But there's been several studies in the past few years about how literature can build empathy, which is a way to share, of course, and understand the feelings of people different from ourselves. And this acts, I think, as a kind of healing. So I want to ask you, as a writer, do you see a shared purpose in that respect to the doctors that you work with?
That's such an interesting question. No one has asked that one before.
Well, that was my personal experience. Maybe they haven't read your book right after, you know, the election results like I did.
It's something that is now really being emphasized in medical school in a way it wasn't before. I think nursing as a field has always focused on empathy. Physicians were trained to really think about pathology and diagnoses and data and not really treat their patients as patients, even though anyone who's had a good family medicine doctor that they've been with for many years knows that that's really what it's about, is relationship building.
So that would be the bedside manner part of being a physician?
Right, and you get to know the entire family dynamic, especially if you are a family medicine doc who might treat parents and children over a course of many years. You really know your patients well in a way that a subspecialist really doesn't ever get to know their patients. There's actually a new field of narrative medicine, and there's a couple of programs in the country around it, and there's a huge emphasis on teaching doctors about storytelling, getting them to really understand how to speak to their patients more than just being a good listener. And there's interesting things happening in the field, and I think the younger physicians are really getting more training in what they call sort of medical humanities than physicians previously did. I think, you know, the model of the country doctor and the house calls was actually a really brilliant model. There's so much you learn about a family when you go to the home and you see how they're living and you see healthcare risks that you wouldn't see when someone comes to your office and maybe puts on a bit of a facade about their health. It's very difficult for people to be honest with their physicians. And one of the things I've thought about a lot in talking about this book is how much people revere the field. Even folks who are tremendously successful, maybe very, very wealthy, maybe very demanding in every other aspect of their lives, kind of treat their doctors as this separate, special kind of individual. So it's one of the few professions that people still have a lot of reverence for. And people have really complex relationships with their physicians for that reason, because you see people who are normally not vulnerable in the rest of their lives. And I see this at work because we deal with a lot of high net worth families.
You mentioned the 1/10%.
Yes.
The upper 1/10%.
Yes. But those people can be tremendously vulnerable when they're in their physician's hands.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Melissa Yancey, author of the new collection of short stories, Dog Years. That answer kind of addresses the physician as storyteller. Mm-hmm. What about the writer as
healer?
Yeah, as healer.
I think if you don't see it, you know, as an empathetic act, it's hard, at least for me, it'd be hard to write. I was telling some students the other day that I sort of think of writing in terms of the imaginative impulse, which is the child writer, the builder of worlds, the teller of fables, that sort of raw instinct for story that everyone has. I think we all have the imaginative impulse. And then in your teenage years, maybe the expressive impulse emerges a little more, where you feel the need to be heard and you are looking for a way to make yourself heard. And then when you get a little older, I think your writing often can become fueled more by an empathetic impulse where you see an individual and you have this moment of curiosity. What is it like to live that life? What is the day to day? And you can't stop thinking about that. And so over time, those impulses merge. And you might start writing something with some curiosity, but then you find you're expressing things about yourself that maybe you wouldn't be able to access otherwise if you took a direct route at it. But that empathetic impulse of exploring someone else's day-to-day often gives you access to your own emotions that you might not be able to speak quite as plainly, at least for me. I think I can access a lot more.
Oh, no, I completely understand. In fact, the next question I wanted to ask is very much related to that. In almost all the stories in Dog Ears, you take characters who are very different from each other, or some who are estranged from the rest of the world, damaged in some way. There's several stories where the main characters like that. And you show them making a connection, a healing connection in a lot of cases. For the character, I think in some cases for the reader, I know for me, there's a story called Go Forth where it's literal, where the characters are kidney transplant donors and recipients. And then there's stories where it's psychological, like the last story in the book, Stray, where the main character, Lily, is described by her coworkers, and this is a quote from the book, as an open wound. Mm-hmm. She overhears that. And she finds healing by taking in a young girl that she just finds abandoned on the streets of San Francisco. Was that one of your objectives when writing these stories, that sense of connection in terms of getting to that empathy?
I think it's must reflect my worldview. The stories have dark situations and some dark humor, but by and large, they have a redemptive tone, I think. There's a lot of hope, I think, in the stories. They're not always happy, but you have a sense that there's still some possibility for these characters. You see a moment of either redemption, if it's a day of reckoning story, which some of these are, or a sense that at least moment to moment, their lives can be really rich and rewarding, even if their other circumstances are pretty trying.
I found that actually in most of the stories in the book, there's one that is quite an exception to that. Mm-hmm. And this story, it stood out for me because it was a failed connection. Mm-hmm. And it's the story Firstborn. So this is about a woman with an alcohol problem. She's about to take her niece on a long promised trip to Paris. It's been postponed for about 13 years or so, I think, something like that. And in this story, there's what seems to be an overzealous attempt at connection. And throughout, as it goes on, it just becomes awkward and uncomfortable for both of the characters in the book. And I think as the reader, you know, you kind of share in that discomfort. I read that you based the main character there, Laurie, on a member of your own family.
Yes, my aunt.
So what is the connection there? It seems this was the one story in the book where it just seemed the connection was attempted and not made. I was wondering, why did this one kind of break the mold, a failed connection rather than that kind of even a little bit of redemption at the end that the other stories have?
Well, in some ways, it's still a day of reckoning story. And I think of the story as her last hurrah. She's about to leave on her last hurrah. After this trip, it is all downhill from here. But this is sort of the last moment where she can live in her delusion a little bit. And I think she reconciles, even in a very superficial way, her life choices. She fails to connect with her niece, and it is overzealous, as you said. And at the end, she kind of tells herself, you made the right choices by not being a wife, by choosing to be a mistress and an aunt instead of a wife and a mother. And I think she really believes that, even if it doesn't seem entirely true to us as the reader. It seems a little sad and empty. But as she goes off, I feel like she gets to have these experiences, however infrequent, and she has lived a rich life of the mind, even if her outer circumstances
don't. She's in her own world in a way. In another story, you mentioned a line that just comes to mind. Mm-hmm. Here, where believing in lies is a way of attaining hope, of being hopeful. Mm-hmm. And she certainly has these delusions that I guess make her hopeful. I mean, she seems to be in awful shape to the reader, objectively.
She is. She is. And my aunt and uncle in particular were just profoundly delusional in a way that was really entertaining to me when I was a kid. I thought my aunt was quite exotic and she was very eccentric, but to me as a child, it looked really exciting that she had these cosmopolitan ideas about the world and a funny way of dressing, and loved to tell these stories about Paris and relationships she had had and her past lives. And she really wanted to write an autobiography. And that was, everything was going to go into the book, and she would tell you how great this autobiography was going to be once she had written it, and she loved to talk about it. And the funny thing was, she had this bizarre idea that my sister, my older sister, was her child. She really did tell my mother, you'll have the children for all of us, and your firstborn will be my child. So once she had that idea in her head, it didn't really matter that my sister was nothing like her. She thought this one was mine. So it's based on a true story. I didn't really have to imagine all that much for this one.
No, that's a lot of the detail that's in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Is your aunt still alive?
She's not.
Oh, okay.
She's
so
not.
She hasn't read the story. That was my question.
I think she would have loved it.
Uh-huh.
She would have absolutely loved it, even though it does paint her as an alcoholic, which she was. She died of cirrhosis. So this trip to Paris really was, I think of it as her last hurrah before she'd saved up money for this trip and was certainly not going to have money to take any other trips. And I think it was downhill from there. So I like to kind of imagine her in this moment. As sad as it is, it was less sad than what came after.
No, that explains the story to me. I mean, it stands very well on its own. Mm-hmm. It's just a little bit different than the others.
It is.
I wasn't quite as hopeful for her, even though she was on her way to Paris and she might have been having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't, yeah. It, as you mentioned, it was probably all downhill from there. You've said in an interview that about the book that time is an essential subject here. I'm quoting, "It's a subject that tortures me the most and the thing that on some level I'll always be writing about." That was about a year ago. Then you had a very recent interview in Salon. You added that the book is about how time makes suckers of us all. Can you give us some examples in the stories?
Yes.
I guess pretty much every story is involved with that. You go back and forth in time. And
I didn't realize it until I read all the stories together when I was editing. Once it had already won the Drew Hines Prize and I was editing it, and I read all the stories in order, which I'd never done before since these stories had been written over many, many years, I thought, well, they're about medicine and they're about parents and children. And I was trying to get an idea of what I wanted the cover of the book to be, because they were very open to suggestion. And I realized all these stories are about time in one way or another. And that led to this image of the exploding, I guess you would call it, exploding alarm clock that's on the cover. But I think Dog Years probably deals with time most explicitly.
Oh, the story?
The title story. Because you have this extraordinary situation where they have a child that's regressing physically. So that there's two parents and their son has Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So starting at around, you know, age 8 or 9, each year, a boy that's affected with Duchenne's will have less and less muscular control. So to see your child, normally there's this bittersweet pain in seeing your child grow up. You want time to go forward and backwards and stop all at once. And that feels so painful. But when, as your child grows, they're degenerating, it's a very different relationship with time. And it kind of plays off the movie premise, you know, that there are these two scientists racing against the clock to find a cure, which if this were a Hollywood movie, that would be the story.
With Susan Sarandon.
Yes, exactly. But So the story really plays with that aspect. But these are their lives. They are trying to find a cure, but they know they'll never find a cure in time for their son. And there's kind of the relationship with Ellen, the mother, and the day-to-day demands of the clock on her time. When there's a scene right at the beginning where they're shopping in a big box store, and she goes across the aisle and she sees these plates and thinks, oh, if we bought these plates, we could have people over and we could do something for the summer and have some little party. And then she realizes the plates are on sale because summer is over. So even though I am not in this situation in any way, nothing about my life is like their lives. Their situation reflects how time feels to me. So it was a way of getting at that through a more extreme lens, but time is always getting away from me. I am that person who looks at the plates and realizes, oh, wait, it's September. How did that happen? I mean, that's so many of us, I think.
If you'll be so kind, Melissa, I there was what I regarded as just a stunning and wise passage in the first story, Dog Years, on our children and the concept of resiliency.
Sure, I'd love to read that. They tell you about the resiliency of children. They do. But what they do not tell you before you have children of your own is what they will do to your resiliency. How on the one hand, you will see how brittle you are in relation to them, and how on the other, you will develop a resiliency that flows from them and for them, as though taking in secondhand air from their exhalations, and how, if you will ever have to be without them, you will not be put back together again.
Oh, man, that just kind of strikes right out a parent. That last line, that's true. Yeah, and I think maybe that's why a lot of these parent-children stories make such good horror stories, because that's probably the biggest horrible event that could happen to any parent is losing their child or their child becoming something that they're not, you know, like in The Exorcist, being invaded by demons.
Right. And I think not having had children and writing that, that came from being in a children's hospital. There's nothing that will make you put off having children more than being in a children's hospital.
The fear that your child will develop a sickness like that.
I mean, you really see, it's not the, I have another story that is not in this collection that may be out soon that deals with this theme more, but it's not the kids that get you, it's the parents. The children in a hospital, it's remarkable how resilient they are, how much joy they bring to their lives in spite of everything that they're going through. But the parents kill you. And it's so difficult to see. And if you don't already have children, it makes it harder. It definitely made it harder for me. I kept postponing. And now I used to have colleagues that they would read something, we'd be working on a proposal, and they would start crying at their desks. And now I'm in that stage. I went from really just feeling it to it being so present. So it is a challenge in that way.
Well, Melissa Yancey, thanks very much for coming into KBOO and talking with us on Between the Covers.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Melissa Yancey, author of the new collection of short stories, Dog Years. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Melissa for visiting us at KBOO and to all of you for listening.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I've got a